NASA 557, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say we've got three sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, Piston Power, and Avemco Insurance, a world-class provider of aviation insurance.
Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead.
Well, hello, gentlemen. It is another episode of Flight Safety Detectives. It's always good to see you boys. We've got a follow-up to a previous discussion we had about the Delta / Endeavor CRJ that crashed up in Toronto. Now that the TSB of Canada has released some factual information. And of course, they did a good job in putting out a prelim. They gave some good information that apparently came off of not only the flight data recorder, but there's probably some cockpit voice recorder influence as well. And we'll get into this because there are a couple shortcomings, things that I would have liked to see in this prelim that could enhance, because there are too many gaps, as we've been talking about off the air. There are too many gaps, too much leeway for people to make a storyline out of what took place, even with this factual information. And that storyline most likely will end up being wrong when the holes are filled by good information from the TSB, but that won't be for some little while. So getting into it, Todd, I know that you did the initial pull of the data and everything else, and then we've been talking about it. I know that during our early discussion, right after the accident, when we did our show, I mean, I did a back of the napkin calculation. It was obvious they were in a high rate of descent at impact. You don't drive a landing gear into the wing and then break the wing off, you know, doing 500 feet per minute down. I did some rough calculations, and so did you. And I think we came up initially with around 1,100 feet per minute, which was pretty damn good, given the fact that at touchdown, the TSB calculated it to be 1,098. So, you know, not bad for just using some ADS-B data that's floating around out there on the internet. So with that being said, John, I'll give you our first word, since I always give you our last word. What's your first impressions of this prelim?
The very first thing after reading all of it was in, and I really focused in on the end of the flight. And I sort of was unhappy with everybody blaming the crew in this one, because I'm not ready to jump on that yet. You know, this whole event is in the last, you know, less than a minute. That's crunch time. A lot of things happening. Windy. You know, this whole thing could have its origins in the gusting wind. We just don't know enough. Where's the flight data recorder is going to tell us more than what they had put out in this report. So I'm not ready to jump on the crew just yet.
Yeah. Todd, what did you think?
Well, at first I was, when this first happened, of course, we had very little to go on. And what little we did have was from the largely publicly available information out there, which in this case dovetailed with what the TSB said. But we just, you just told me a few minutes ago about something that might be another set of data points that could shed light on this. There was another Endeavor, CRJ-9, in LaGuardia just a week before we did this taping, which had a similarly strong gusty condition, and it had a wingtip strike aborted the landing, came around and landed safely. But this calls into question, is there something not just with the aircraft or with the crews, but with the procedures that are being done? I don't know what the TSB is doing with respect to looking at Endeavor procedures, because this preliminary report did not go into that detail. But we do know from just literally checking the NTSB website that there is an NTSB investigation underway of this wingtip strike. I'm not sure to what level they'll investigate it, but it seems reasonable that these two investigations will be going hand in hand going forward.
And that brings up a good point, and that that gets to training. Given the fact that they've had now two events, one being successful, they did drag a wingtip. The fact is that they were able to milk that airplane around and get it back on the ground safely. But the question is there a training issue? Is there a policy or procedures issue? It'll be interesting to see who was flying that particular flight. Was it a relatively new or inexperienced first officer? And inexperience is a bad term, but it's the only term to use, because the young lady who was the first officer on the Toronto accident had been with the airline a year, had accumulated about 1,400 hours of total flight time, 400 of which were in the CRA J9. Now, people are going, oh, my God, what happened with, you know, Continental Express and Congress getting involved and saying you had to have 1,500 hours and an ATP and things like that? Well, for those that aren't plugged into aviation or are in aviation and don't follow it very well, the FAA allowed for limited or restricted ATPs to be issued based on conditions, conditions being education. And Todd, I know that we just looked at that together, and you're going to put it up on the web. Why don't you just briefly summarize it?
Yes, I looked at the FAA's website, and they actually had quite a bit of information about the options that exist for someone to be a transport pilot without having 1,500 hours. In fact, there are three different levels of exceptions. You can have up to 1,000 hours for a graduate of a bachelor's degree program with an aviation major that meets the minimum requirements of 61.160 Bravo. And there are literally dozens of schools. Some of them are well-known, Embry-Riddle, your alma mater, Greg, and many others that have programs where you can go through that, meet the requirement for 1,000 hours. You can have 1,250 if you have an associate's degree and an aviation major from an institution that otherwise meets the requirements. And the same thing for someone who has a bachelor's degree with an aviation major and meets other requirements. So you can be a transport pilot in a U.S. airline with less than 1,500 hours. There will be restrictions. I believe Greg, you told me offline that they could not be the pilot in command, but they could be a pilot who is in the flight crew.
Correct. And the military, you only need 750 hours to get a restricted ATP. So, you know, the FAA recognized that coming out of these formal institutions with a high level of aviation education, they had, you know, pilots had the background and the knowledge. And so there was a lot of early talk about this young lady who was flying the airplane at the time. And, you know, there were assertions made about DEI and a variety of other things. You know, none of the facts had been established yet. All we had was basically video and, you know, storylines were built. Now we have some factual information, and looking at the way the TSB has presented those facts, it does leave some things for interpretation. But as John said, the wind was gusty. There is a correction factor that all pilots typically know about, and that is you find your ref speed, whatever that is, based on the weight of your aircraft, and then you basically add half the gust. So in this case, as the report points out, their VREF speed was 139, and they're adding a gust factor of plus 5 knots. Now, that's because it's restricted up to 10 knots total. And why, how they came up with that math, because there were some odd numbers in there, and the fact that they flew this approach at 145, not 144, and then they got into 150 or 154, 155. There were a lot of variations in that indicated airspeed versus the ground speed. That's where a lot of the confusion may occur. They didn't give us an indication of whether the wind shifted. They just told us, or at least asserted, that there was a gusty wind condition. And then you do the simple mental gymnastics of mathematics. There was a gusting wind condition, quartering right wind condition, about 40 degrees off the nose, that varied from the high 20s even into the 30s. And so that has a positive and a negative influence on the aircraft as far as performance is concerned. And then, of course, the TSB in their report talk about the fact that based on the flight data recorder, the flying pilot was initially carrying about 64% power, then reduced that to 43% power, but the power never moved after that. Well, if you're in a gusty wind condition, you know, whether you're flying a piston banger, you know, general aviation airplane or a jet, you're constantly moving that throttle or the thrust levers back and forth, you know, staying on speed, and you're going to be correcting for a gust similar to what you would be doing in a wind shear environment, things like that. So they don't have any explanation for that. And it will be very interesting, given what you said, Todd, about the fact that there was another event involving another Endeavor crew with another Endeavor aircraft under similar conditions, except this 40-knot quartering headwind crosswind was coming from the left. That's why they dragged the left wing. It'll be interesting to see the common denominators between Toronto and LaGuardia, and then really look at the training program at Endeavor. What kind of scenarios, since typically all the airlines use a scenario-based training program, what are the scenarios that they're giving their pilots in these kinds of conditions? And what are they evaluating as far as how they perform and things like that? And you struck it with the comment about, you know, procedures. What are the procedures that they're taking into the cockpit?
And also, there was literally 1 month between the Toronto event and the LaGuardia event. And one question I'd have is, were there any changes made to the curriculum and to the training or the requirements in that short period of time? Now, true, the investigation is ongoing, but it seems reasonable to me that the airline knows their system very well, and they might have spotted something that had to be changed or should be changed. It's also good to see that the NTSB is actually investigating this wingtip strike event in LaGuardia. So I suspect there will be some communication between the TSB and the NTSB to address these very same questions.
Yeah, and John, I know that when before we got on the air, we were talking about the fact that one of the issues when we look at events like this, it does get down to what's going on at an airline, whether it's Endeavor, Delta, American, or whatever. What's going on at the airline? Are they ramming people through to get them in the cockpit? It's obvious they meet the qualifications, whether it's on paper or whatever. The fact is they meet a qualification standard. But are they bringing it into the cockpit? And then the other question I have is, what was the captain doing during all of this? Is there any kind of limitation? Do you have a high min captain? Do you have a high min first officer? What's going on with that? Was he coaching? Was he ready to take the aircraft? I mean, is there any kind of limitation that prevents a first officer from landing in these types of conditions?
When we finally get to see the transcript from the voice recorder, that's going to be an interesting read, because this was an IOE flight, which means initial operating experience on the part of this first officer. So this is not just the captain in the left seat. This is a training captain. He's evaluating the first officer. So he's supposed to be on alert, and he's supposed to be watching everything. You know, this whole event happened in less than 20 seconds. We had a nice stabilized approach, and inside of 20 seconds, actually maybe a little less, we have a mess looking at the touchdown point. It's a busy time. And just think of how long it took us to dissect all the numbers to figure out were they on speed and all the rest of it. And these two people in the cockpit have less than 20 seconds to do all that. It's a challenge.
One thing that stood out to me when looking at the personnel here, the captain and the first officer, the first officer actually had quite a bit of very recent experience. In the previous 30 days, she'd actually flown in and out of the accident airport three times before the accident flight, and had been something on the order of 56 hours in the previous 30 days, whereas the captain had worked 3 days in the previous seven as an instructor and only had 3.5 hours in the previous 30 days. So this is a training captain. This is someone who obviously is well-versed in the aircraft, but fact of the matter is the first officer had roughly 10 times as much recent hours in the previous 30 days compared to the captain.
And that, of course, brings up a good point. Because you do have, you know, training captains, and how far do you let somebody go? And in these kinds of wind conditions, I know, okay, yeah, you can do it in a simulator. And if you screw it up, you hit, you know, pause or whatever, and you do it again. Can't hit pause here. And again, that's why I'm asking whether or not there was some sort of limitation for a Hyman first officer, given the fact that, as John said, she's in an IOE period. I mean, yeah, you got to get the operating experience, but you got to be cocked and loaded as the pilot in command, ready to take the aircraft. You can't coach somebody through, especially when the bottom falls out. The fact is that they landed flat. They only had it at 1 degree nose up attitude at impact, according, or at touchdown, according to the TSB. We all know, and it's very evident, that when that airplane touches down, it's at a higher nose high attitude than 1 degree. That airplane hit real flat, and it was right wing low. Now you roll that, you got to roll that wind correction out so that you land basically on the mains. You may land on the right main first, but not with, I mean, I can't remember the last number, 7 to 10 degrees right wing down. On touchdown, that's a lot, especially given the fact that that's a short landing gear, long wing, and, you know, the possibility of dragging a wing or catching a wing is always there. So, and that may have been what happened at LaGuardia. They had the wind correction in and didn't get the wind correction out prior to getting close to the runway. All of these things have to be evaluated, but the bigger thing is they have to be put in context. You can't just say, well, see, she was this or he was that, or, you know, the conditions were such. You have to keep things in context, because we have pilots that land in wind conditions like this all the time very successfully. The question is, you know, are these pilots trained, properly prepared based on the training program? Are there sufficient procedures and oversight in place to prevent incidents and accidents like these?
We're going to take a short break now to meet one of Avemco's employees from their Frederick, Maryland office.
Well, JT, I understand that you have years and years of experience in insurance business, but you're here for 2 years, is that correct?
A little over 2 years,
Why
yes.
did you come here?
For a change of scenery, let's say. Been in the business and industry for a long time, P&C side, underwriting claims, everything, marketing. I've worked with some of those people in the past, prior carrier, and thought it would be interesting, educational, something new I wanted to try and learn about. So I took the leap, and I love it. Absolutely love it.
So what makes you an expert in aviation, since you're talking with pilots and trying to determine whether or not Avemco is going to insure them?
The pilots themselves have been my best teachers. Speaking with the pilots over the last 2+ years has been fantastic. It's been such a great learning experience, learning curve for me. I've learned so much. They also, we've done ground school. We've had CFI come in, give us hours of ground school, worked in a simulator, going to the flight shows, different things, Sonathon, Oshkosh, do the NAFI summit, things like that, talking to the folks down there. It's been absolutely great learning experience and a pleasure for me. I enjoyed it immensely.
So what's been really the most challenging element of this business now that you're on the aviation side?
Learning the ins and outs of the planes. The underwriting side, I know how to underwrite. I get the information I need from people, but learning about the types of planes that we're insuring, that was the biggest learning curve. And I think I've got a pretty good grasp on that now from talking to the pilots and in-house education. So that was the biggest challenge, going from, say, commercial buildings to Cessnas or Pipers or something like that.
to the Flight Safety Detectives.
Now, the other thing about this is the extra attention that's being paid to aviation accidents in the States, at least recently, because we've gone through literally years without major events, and we have two within the last couple of months. And unfortunately, some of the public discussions out there has little to do with the actual facts of the situation and more to do with people's social perceptions of, is aviation safe? Have corners been cut? Are we having people in the cockpit who shouldn't be there? All these questions are legitimate questions and that people are asking them. They may not be legitimate in these investigations. As the facts come forward, we'll have a better idea of whether to respond directly or indirectly to those kinds of things. But until then, it's up to the experts at TSB to take over. And here's where I'd like to ask you something, Greg, because you've actually worked directly with the TSB in mm-hmm. previous major accidents. And Canada, although it has a significant amount of traffic, really doesn't have that many accidents involving major airliners. But you've been involved in one of those.
And they do a very good job. They have a very, very good state-of-the-art lab up there when it comes to reading out flight data recorder information, cockpit voice recorder information. They get a very competent professional investigative cadre up there as well. The good thing is the NTSB is you know, right across the border. And so we typically will assist, since this was a Delta Airlines, Endeavor Airlines event. The board is there as a resource. They're there as technical advisors, along with other parties to the investigation, which make up the airline, the manufacturer, the aircraft, the engine manufacturer, et cetera. The FAA is there as well because they're interested in continued airworthiness of the aircraft to see if there's any kind of issue. So there is a lot of subject matter expertise at the disposal of the TSB to get it right. That is to collect all the facts, conditions, and circumstances, and then present them in a context that's logical. They don't come up with necessarily a probable cause statement. They come up with causal factors and findings. When you read them, you'll get the same impression as if it were to say the probable cause is. The fact here is that we still have too many gaps. I would love to read the transcript of the interview of both the captain and the first officer. That's going to be critical. And like John said, now the TSB, the Canadians don't typically publish, or at least when I worked with them, they didn't typically publish a cockpit voice recorder transcript like we do here in the States. They summarize it. They'll give you an idea. They may even quote from it. I want to know if those jive. I want to know what was being done in the cockpit, if that jives with the statements and the perceptions of both flight crew members in an interview setting, just to see, did something come out on the CVR that they didn't talk about in an interview or vice versa. John and I have been through this before when I did the Charlotte DC-9 that crashed and killed 23 people. They were on the approach. First officer was flying the airplane. Captain was the monitoring pilot. They got into this rain shaft in a wind shear event. And during the missed approach, the go around, they ended up hitting the ground. And there were things on the cockpit voice recorder, a particular statement that was made by the captain. It was clear what he said. It was clear it was the captain, the non-flying pilot, who basically gave the first officer a command. And unfortunately, the airplane crashed. When we interviewed the surviving captain, he said, "I never said that." We listened to it multiple times. It's like, there's nobody else in the cockpit except you two guys. He said, "I never said it." So there are always little things that, one, have to be corroborated. Two, you may hear something on a CVR that the crew doesn't remember either hearing or saying. We've had that. We had a Texas International DC-9, if I remember right, and I think a couple of other foreign carriers, where you can hear the gear warning horn just blaring on the cockpit voice recorder, and these guys still land gear up in a big airplane, and it's like, what happened? And they go, "We never heard a horn." You can hear it clear as day on the CVR because they're either engrossed in an activity running checklists, you know, they got a situation and, you know, they've gotten so focused. So all of these little things, it's going to be interesting to see what the dynamic is. John was talking about what the dynamic was in that last minute of flight between the crew members. How did they evaluate the weather? Did they evaluate it properly? Did they think that, okay, we're carrying the 5 knots, we're good to go? Or, hey, why don't you bump it up another 5 knots? You know, now, because, you know, when you're flying big airplanes, there's basically a rule of thumb out there for every knot of extra airspeed, that's about 100 feet you're going to cover across the ground. Now, they're landing on they are landing on a long runway. Problem is, part of it may have been contaminated. And, you know, did they factor all of this in? So there's so many still unanswered questions that hopefully when all the facts come out, we'll have answers to a lot of these questions and the gaps filled.
We got a very, very accusatory group of people in aviation. Earlier today, I read an airline captain just jumped right in and blaming the flight crew. Jumped right in. It's just too early. I mean, people get the facts, and we don't have all the facts. And fortunately for us, the three of us, and of course our other friends that we have on, we don't do that. We will give opinions sometimes, and we'll say it's an opinion, but we don't jump to the conclusions like other people do.
Yeah, and we're basing it on the facts as we know them at the time we basically record these shows. Will the facts change? Absolutely. That's why the MTSB, and that's why the TSB in this case, put a banner up there that says this is preliminary information only, subject to change. It is subject to change every single day. And like with the midair collision in Washington, a lot of people jumped on the bandwagon blaming, you know, one set of crew members. And next thing you know, all of a sudden now, as new facts come out, maybe it wasn't so much the crew as it was an issue with the aircraft and, you know, crew's misinterpretation and a variety of other things. So we try to couch it and put context to those known facts. But like we're talked about in this show, there are still a lot of holes. There are gaps. And the context really isn't there. All we know, they got into a high rate of sink. At the very end of the flight, they hit the ground hard, they busted the right wing, and the airplane rolled over. But we really don't understand what the primacy is with regard to crew action versus Mother Nature, if you will, and the, you know, actions and inactions that may or may not have taken place during that period of time.
And one thing I think I certainly look forward to in this investigation is the fact that there, like you said, a lot of other things might come out, a lot of other things that are not clear right now. And one of the things I'm keeping in mind is that there's a difference in the way that TSB does an investigation versus NTSB. And the biggest difference is some of the ancillary data that we're used to getting from the NTSB, the public docket information, which often is redundant to what's in the final report, but often says and discusses things that were not in the major report, could be very insightful. In this particular case, we happen to have two events, same airline, same aircraft type, one done by the NTSB, one done by the TSB. And I suspect that given the circumstances of these two, there's going to be some similarities, similar questions answered, similar data being collected. I'm looking forward to see how much information the TSB has, how much the NTSB has, and how well those two fill up each other's gaps.
And I think that that's a good segue to talk about the fact that we're going to have to wait. you know, these investigations take a long time. But I think that as the investigation progresses, the bulk of the information has already been collected. Now it's just a matter of interpretation of the data and how it is affecting the operation of the aircraft and things like that. So I think that hopefully, within probably the next 6 months, we're going to have a very good idea if the TSB releases more information that has better fidelity to it, that we'll be able to really come up with a bottom line And the bigger thing is, what are the recommendations to improve the system so that things like this type of accident don't happen again? So with that being said, Todd, I'm going to leave you with our second to the last word.
Well, this is going to be a first-time type of second to last word. This is going to be an appeal to a particular person. As many of you saw from our earlier show on this event, there was a video shot from an aircraft waiting to take off. The aircraft was in close proximity to the landing aircraft. Very good information was available from that video, some of which we used in the previous show. This is information that might be of use to the TSB. While there are voice recordings and other recordings, what you don't have normally in an aircraft is any kind of video recording. We were lucky here. We, meaning the aviation community, there was a close-up video of this aircraft where you can see things about the performance of the aircraft that may not be in the interior data in the flight data recorders. It could confirm some of the data in the flight data recorder, which I think it already has. Whoever this person is, there's enough information out there to identify the specific aircraft and the operator of that aircraft. We're not going to share that now because it's not really relevant. I personally have reached out to the company asking to get in touch with the pilot. I've been unsuccessful so far, so now I'm asking you, the aviation community, if you know this pilot or if you are the pilot, reach out to us. Let's talk. I'm not in the business of ratting anybody out or getting anybody in trouble, but I'm saying that this piece of video is a vital piece of evidence. It deserves to be part of the investigation.
Yeah, and we'd like to just talk because it's like, why were you recording that particular airplane while you were sitting and waiting? What was it that drew your attention to it and prompted you to hit record? That's what I want to know, because videos like this don't surface every day. And this became, I think, valuable for those of us that watched it, including the three of us, that gave us a better perspective than what we knew the day before this video ever showed up. So with that, John, I will leave you with our last word.
And as usual, I will just tell everybody that if you're going to go flying, to please, please do a good job of pre-planning your flight, including the weather here, there, and everywhere in between. When you get out to the airport, a good pre-flight. Interestingly, I just spent the last 3 days of last week with an operator, and I didn't know this in advance, but the subject of pre-flights was right on the agenda. Right, and we had a good over an hour discussion about pre-flights and on all the issues they have with the pre-flights that aren't done to the level that they think they're being done. And even with this group, I gave my plea that I always do. The pilots don't feel comfortable with a pre-flight. Get the mechanic out there that knows about that airplane, that type of airplane, and pick his brain. And those of us in the maintenance community, don't resist that. Help our brothers in this business, because I've seen too many pilots that don't know. You know, and I'll go back to the one pilot I talked to and who would open the panel and then close the panel. And I interrupted him and said, "What did you just do? What did you look at?" And he said he had no clue. It just said he had to open the panel looking. That's not what the pre-flight's all about. All right, so if you're not comfortable or you feel like you could use some help in it, get the help, because it's so damn important. And after you get in the air, put that head on a swivel. We still get, and also at the same conference, we talked about near misses at airports. They fly into a lot of regional airports and untowered airports. And they had a lot of horror stories about near misses. So put that head on a swivel, please. Please, you don't want to get involved with anyone else's misadventures. So, and please, please, fly safely.
Thank you so much for listening to the show. We really value all of our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you. So if you like this, give us 5 stars inside your podcast platform.
We want to keep the conversation going with you, so we'd love for you to engage with us on our social media channels. We're on Instagram, X, Facebook, LinkedIn, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com. By the way, if you're watching this on YouTube, we're working on growing this channel, and it really helps if you all comment. So please do that. We read them all.
And be sure to subscribe.
Not all aircraft insurance policies and premiums are the same. As the only direct writer in the market, Avemco never uses third-party insurance agents and instead connects you directly with an aviation underwriter in their Frederick, Maryland office, ready to solve problems and to approve coverage based on what you fly and how you fly it. Avemco provides lightning-fast quotes, competitive rates, and personalized policies that are easy to read and tailored to you. Call 888-879-0389 for your free quote, or visit avemco.com/flightsafety. Don't forget to tell them you're a listener of our podcast and save 5%.
Premium credits are subject to underwriting guidelines, including Avemco-recognized training and memberships.